6. And as a reminder, the conference call is being recorded. If anyone is tweeting today and wants to tweet out comments, we'll try to monitor that. If you have questions, Dave Vellante, who's here in the studio with me, will watch the tweets, hashtag Wikibon. So WIKIBON. So any questions or comments, please tweet those out. We have with us today Paul Martin. Paul is the IT manager at Pool & Grain. And I met Paul at a recent VMware Technology User Group meeting here in Marlborough, Massachusetts, just down the street from the Wikibon offices. And so we were having an interesting discussion, and I asked Paul if he would be willing to come on and discuss his environment, his challenges, and some of the technologies that he's looking at to try to improve his data protection capabilities. So, Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We also have with us David Floyer on the line. I think I heard David on. Nick Allen, also a Wikibon analyst, and here in the studio with me is Dave Vellante. Dave and David are co-founders of Wikibon. So Paul, why don't you, the topic of today's discussion is enterprise-class data protection on a small business budget, and you really do have a small business budget. Why don't you start by just telling us a little bit about Pool & Grain and then some of the challenges that you're trying to address.
All right, John, thanks. Pool & Grain has been around since 1932. We are a fourth-generation Vermont family-owned company. We've got three manufacturing facilities, two in northern Vermont, one of which I happen to be currently our corporate office up in Newport, Vermont. In addition to the two Vermont locations, we also have a manufacturing facility up in upstate New York. Those three locations keep me quite busy. I'm the only IT guy. We've got two data centers, one primary here at the corporate office, and then one disaster recovery location. And we service about 120 independently owned distributorships all around the northeastern part of the United States. We're a small company, but we do serve and service a large population. As such, we find ourselves kind of in a unique position in that our environment has we see very real problems. We see very real IT issues that are occurring today, even in our limited environment, because we are trying to do so much with so little. And that being the case is kind of what has brought us here today. We find ourselves in a position.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say we find ourselves in a position where our current backup infrastructure isn't meeting our needs. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Tell us a little bit about your current backup situation, environment, technologies that you're using, what's working, what's not working, and where the challenges are.
All right. In 2008, we virtualized our entire infrastructure, and it's worked well for us. We've adopted Veeam as a backup solution, backup software provider, and that software is backing up to a primary backup repository made by Exagrid. The Exagrid is deduping and replicating itself to a disaster recovery location, which is one of my remote offices. And right now, we find ourselves running out of capacity on those Exagrid devices.
On both sides, you're running out of capacity?
Yeah. Initially, a couple of months ago, I started really noticing that the backup capacity at my VR location, it's a smaller capacity Exagrid because we weren't sending all of our virtual machines. We weren't sending all of them over to the DR site. The thought was that we would only go ahead and send critical data over. So initially, what I was seeing was that the DR location's Exagrid was filling up, at the same time, too, I mean, it goes without saying that the primary one was also, you know, starting to fill up. But it wasn't as noticeable because it's a higher capacity box. Now we're nearing budget time. We're nearing the end of the year, and I'm also nearing the end of capacity on that DR location's extra grid appliance. I also finally noticed that the primary location's extra grid is also in a position where it's starting to run out of capacity. So now, initially, I thought that we were going to have to buy capacity for the DR location, but as it really turns out, the true fix is going to have to be to buy additional capacity for both sides, or figure out some way to give myself more storage capacity at both locations.
This is always kind of a standard question. Do you have a sense of what your data growth rate is?
Right now, what we have found, we bought the first ExaGrid in 2008. We bought the second one in 2010. And based on what I've seen on those two appliances, we're growing at just under about a terabyte a year. Our backup data is growing for just under a terabyte a year.
Okay. And what are
right
the
now,
what are the applications that are driving the growth?
Primarily I'd have to say that the biggest application driving the growth is our line of business software. I mean, you can do whatever you want as far as you know, limiting people's mailbox sizes and telling them to just delete old files they may no longer need. But, you know, unfortunately, to run the business and the largest offender, for lack of a better word, in the capacity area right now is our ERP, our line of business software.
Okay. So, what are some of the options that you've considered in terms of dealing with the growth in data and dealing with the need to back up and then replicate to the recovery site?
Well, I've visited this actually a number of times in the past, directly or indirectly, depending on your point of view, in that what I've done is instead of replicating all of my servers, the first step that I did was I started separating out the critical servers from the non-critical ones. And then take that a step further, we have, you know, tried to prioritize and take ones out that maybe weren't quite as critical. We've added capacity over time. We've trimmed files over time. We've changed retention policies. I think I'm down to like an 8-day retention policy on my file server. Ideally, I like to keep a couple of weeks. I mean, it's not out of the question for somebody to come up to you and say they need a spreadsheet that they overwrote from a couple of weeks ago. It happens to all of us. But I've had to adjust my retention policies because of the capacity constraints that I have. And now I'm looking at hopefully the ultimate solution of cloud backup.
And for you, what's attractive about cloud backup?
I think first and foremost, I don't want to say limitless capacity, but nearly limitless capacity. I don't like, and I think it's an extremely inefficient waste of time to have to keep going back and revisiting the same problem over and over again. Now, granted, you, if the problem was fixed right the first time, but really, who knows how much your data is going to grow and how much your business is going to grow? In a perfect world, both would grow exponentially. The business would grow, and as a result of the business growing, the data would as well. I think that a driver for me is going to be cost. It's going to be a huge cost, a huge driver for me. Ease of use and the fact for me, it needs to really implement with the technologies that I've already worked so hard to put into place, and that seem to be working so well for me. There needs to be a compatibility.
The Veeam software is working well for you, and the ExaGrid is working well for you. Is that what I'm hearing? So you want to incorporate?
They are both working well. The problem is that the ExaGrid appliance is a costly solution. It works extremely well, but it's cost prohibitive for me to continue, I believe, using ExaGrid as my backup storage solution.
Right. So, Paul, this is Dave Vellante. I wonder if you could just address
some of the higher level trends here. We've seen for the last, say, 5 to 7 years, data deduplication really came in as a way to reduce costs. And it sounds like in your case, it might have the solution might have addressed some kind of a near-term tactical problem, but it didn't solve your issue long-term, which seems to be elasticity. You want the ability to just basically dial up capacity when you need it. So the data deduplication is kind of a one-time hit that draws capacity down, and then you're back to adding more capacity. Am I getting that right?
In my case, and I obviously can't speak for everyone, but in my case, I think the biggest advantage to deduplication was realized when I first implemented it. After that, it's backups as usual.
Sorry, Paul. We got cut out there for a second. Can you just repeat what you were saying about in your case?
Yeah, absolutely. Deduplication, I think the biggest advantage to deduplication is realized when you first put it into place. The largest amount of savings that you'll see is when you first implement deduplication. After that, it's business as usual. I mean, backups as usual. The amount of data is the amount of data, and over time, it's just going to continue to grow. It's just the nature of the beast. It's nice to say that, yeah, deduplication is the answer to all of our problems, but after that initial implementation where you see all of the duplicate blocks, all of the duplicate files, all of a sudden, you know, fizzle down and you know, down to their smallest form, once that's been done, I mean, you're just backing up data after that.
Can you talk a little bit more about your cloud backup solution and specifically what you did?
Well, right now, if I got that right, you're looking at, but you haven't implemented cloud backup, correct?
That's correct. In fact, I'm looking at a lot of different players. I've talked to some of them that have been very, very helpful. I've talked to, interestingly enough, a couple of them that haven't been very helpful. I mean, first and foremost, I'm coming into this, you know, really with a learning curve ahead of me. I don't understand the technology. I didn't understand the technology. Not that I'm any expert now, but I didn't understand the requirements of it. I didn't understand the costs behind it. I mean, like any other project in our world, there's a learning curve ahead of it, and you know, there are a lot of things that you don't necessarily know up front going into it. And thankfully, I did run into a couple of people that were very helpful in sharing the information that I needed. But yeah, to answer your question, I've looked at, I'm going to guess probably 8, 10, 12 different cloud providers so far, and I'm only a little bit closer than I was 2 weeks ago to finding a solution. So
but basically the justification, the business case is, as we were talking about before, that ability to get capacity on demand, you called it nearly infinite. So what have you learned in your research, and what are your concerns, and you know, how are you evaluating the risks and the rewards?
Which technologies do you think are promising and which are not?
Well, I mean, given my position, IT manager of an SMB, my budgets are very limited. So cost is going to have to be a huge consideration for me. Of all of the solutions that I've found, I mean, I don't know if you want me to say specifically who I've found for providers,
This is a peer insight community, and so we want people to share both their pain and their progress, so that other people.
Oh, all right. Well, the one provider that seemed to really stick out or stand out for me, Amazon has a project called the Glacier Project. The resounding theme, regardless of the provider that you're going with, seems to be that they all charge on a per gigabyte data amount per month. Translated, that comes down to, in Amazon's case, 1 penny per gig per month. Right now, I'm looking at about probably 3 to 5 terabytes that I have for data. That includes that includes my retain data as well, my retention policy. So that one penny per gigabyte per month very easily fits into the budget that we've allowed for data growth for next year.
Does that also enable you to start protecting applications that you're not currently protecting?
No, and that penny is only for the cloud service. There's actually two pieces to that. Not only do you need to pay for a cloud service provider, but you also need to pay for a cloud enabler. You need to have somebody sitting in the middle that's going to translate me into the cloud language and the cloud into my language. Some broker that needs to sit in the middle to act as a caching appliance. I mean, they call it a caching appliance. My personal opinion, it sounds to me like it's primary storage, because what they're doing in a lot of cases is they're using this caching appliance as a point to restore from. I don't know. I guess the definition becomes a little gray between local storage and caching appliance, but it becomes a little more clear, I suppose, when you look at these caching appliances from the aspect that some of them are physical appliances. Okay. Others are virtual machines, an OVF file that I throw into my infrastructure. Well, now that tells me the caching appliance in that case becomes my own storage infrastructure. So I guess really throw your own definition in there, and is this thing a local storage or not? But again, you need an enabling device in most cases, and at least in the ones that I've seen. They call this a hybrid method of cloud storage. There's a couple of companies that were very, well, they said very, very good. Panzura and Twinstrata. The folks that I spoke to at both of those companies, particularly the Panzura person that I spoke with, very, very, very friendly, very knowledgeable. In fact, when I was speaking with the rep, Steve was the gentleman's name. The owner of the company, I think it was the owner of the company or the president of the company, was walking by his office at the same time. Stepped in the office when he heard Steve and I talking, and proceeded to have a dialogue with me and teach me about cloud and teach me about their solution. Even when he went so far as to tell me that even if they're not the solution for me, maybe this one is, and actually gave me a bunch of literature, gave me a bunch of names of companies. And Steve was even willing to give me his contact at Amazon Web Services to tell me a little more about their Glacier cloud project, the cloud service offering.
So that
says quite a lot, because he's selling somebody else's product in that case.
So let's talk about this a little bit. So Glacier, for those of you who don't know, is Amazon's new service. It's a deep archive service, essentially. As Paul said, it's a penny per gigabyte per month, so the price is right. But it's not designed for retrieval. It's really designed for, you know, you put it there and you may never see it again. But I wonder, and then, of course, you're talking about the Panzura and the Twinstrata, which would be a gateway and a cloud on-ramp, essentially, writing, translating to Amazon's APIs, which is the other thing that you've got to do, RESTful APIs. So, Paul, I wonder if you could address that Glacier notion of sort of deep archive. Is this the type of data that you sort of hope to never have to get back again, or is it?
And that's a very good point. I guess the first thing that I should clarify is that I'm trying to find a disaster recovery repository. Now,
right.
Excuse me. In my case, since I'm looking for a disaster recovery repository. I'm looking at secondary backup storage. The AWS, the Glacier project, actually fits very, very nicely into that. So to your question, no, I hope to never, ever touch this again, because that would mean that the big meteor dropped down on my office and probably took me out with it. My hope is that never happens. But yes, the Amazon Glacier is more of a long-term archiving repository, as opposed to a live cloud storage. A live cloud storage destination.
Yeah, it's not an active archive.
One thing.
It's a deep archive
right.
that you're hoping you never have to get to.
And we're not talking about restoring
exactly.
applications. We're not talking about restoring applications. We're talking about restoring data, recovering data.
Yeah, and Amazon will, of course, charge you restoration costs depending upon how fast you want to get it back and how much data. So you're, I'm sure, well aware of that.
Well, they're not the only ones. They're not the only ones. Let me clarify that. There are additional charges. When you subscribe to some sort of a cloud service provider, in addition to the appliances and the stuff that you need to buy, you need to pay for the support. You need to pay for the product, the appliance. You need to pay for what they call puts. You need to pay for what they call gets. And in addition, you're going to pay for bandwidth charges. Depending on how much data you're sending across the pipe, they may charge you based on the amount that they're sending. Interestingly enough, and this is kind of funny, the initial backup, of course, is going to take the longest of all of them. Some of the providers that I've looked at actually will ship you an appliance for the initial streaming of data, the initial backup, and then you send it back to them, and that's how they do their cloud service. It's really been an adventure learning all of the different techniques that these different providers.
Yeah, you're right. Seeding the cloud is oftentimes one of
right.
the hardest things to
yeah.
do, and it's a one-time activity, but it's time-consuming, and the different suppliers have different ways to throttle up or throttle down the pace at which you seed. But that's a big deal, obviously, getting your data into the cloud.
Yeah, and in your case, we're talking about 3 terabytes. We're not talking about, you know, a mid-size or a large company where you got tens or hundreds of terabytes. So,
yeah, but even 3 terabytes.
But
that's
what I'm saying. So that's what I'm saying. At 3 terabytes, it's an issue. What is it
Imagine.
When you get to 30 to 100 or 200? So that's interesting. Yeah. I wanted to stop for a second because I want to make sure that people on the phone have an opportunity to ask some questions of you, Paul, or anyone else that's...
Hi, Paul. This is Scott Lowe. I do have a couple of questions for you. You know, I was a CIO in a small environment for quite a long time. Do you find that working in a small environment it puts you at a sort of a disadvantage when you're working with some of these companies? Like, they're more used to working with quote-unquote real enterprise companies versus the SMB, or has that not been much of a factor?
Scott, thank you very much for asking that question. First of all, hi, thank you very much, big fan.
Thanks.
And there's a company that I ran into that was recommended to me called Nasuni, and they sell what sounds to be a typical product. It's not very unique in any way, I don't think. But what was really interesting to me was the person that I spoke to about more information, the person that I called for more information, seemed to go out of her way to try to talk me out of their product. When she found out that we were an SMB, she didn't do a whole lot to try to sell the product. She did a lot more to try to talk me out of their solution.
Did she
not really quite sure what...
Did she
no, and that was the interesting part. She wanted to get me off the phone as quickly as possible. I'm not quite sure what sales technique that was, but... it didn't work.
you're not a prospect.
Yeah, that I would have to. Yeah, and Scott, thank you again for that question. But I think because we are a small business, maybe folks don't want to deal with us because they don't see us as being any kind of viable source of revenue for them. Certainly not long-term revenue. But
yeah. Now, when you're looking at the cloud service providers, you talked about a number of times. There's a charge for this, there's a charge for that, there's a charge for, you know, puts and gets, there's a charge for bandwidth. Do you feel like that you may be jumping into this and be kind of like, okay, when we get our first bill, who knows what we're going to see? Because it's really kind of tough to predict.
It's like the iPhone bill?
I like the idea that Panzura had. I think it was, they had a one flat fee, 19 cents per gig per month. That covered their support, their product, all your puts, all your gets. Unfortunately, that puts it out of my pricing range. 19 cents is just a little bit too much.
Yeah, that's a lot. I can understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Panzura, you know, they're considered an enterprise grade, you know, company. So you're gonna pay a little bit more for sure.
Yeah.
How about Nervonics? Have you looked into the Nervonics cloud?
No, I have not seen Nirvanix. I've got five different cloud providers that I was looking at, and Nirvanix is one of them. Amazon is the other. That seemed to be doing well. Google Cloud, I want to look at HP Cloud and Rackspace as a cloud as well. I don't know cost wise where any of them stand, but if any of them have an enabling device that they sell with their service or not. I'm not positive.
You're not looking at Oracle?
You know, next company call that I saw last week was Riverbed. They're not going to be necessarily an SMB play, but they do have a virtual appliance that wasn't horrendously pricey.
Whitewater Cross?
Yes.
Yeah.
Zotero was another one that actually seems to be they seem to won a lot of awards, gotten a lot of attention. CTERA. Has anyone heard of that one? And Store Simple is another one that got a lot of attention.
Can you say that? What you said? Did you say Centera or Zotero?
Zotero, CTERA. That one seems to have won some awards and gotten some attention. Store Simple was mentioned a lot by folks that I spoke to.
Yeah, Zotero.
They have an ICE.
Store Simple. Zotero Cloud.
For anyone else on the phone, one of the goals here was to try to help identify any other players that Paul should look at and any other issues that he needs to consider. Anyone want to contribute here?
Not again. You know, I think that it was Dave Vellante that responded when you mentioned you were looking at Amazon Glacier, but our system never got back. It sounds like from a recovery time perspective, Glacier might not be.
Who's speaking, please?
This is Scott.
Oh, hey, Scott. Sorry, you were cutting out a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, so Scott, are you asking the RPO, RTO question?
I am asking that. I know that was a little bit discussed before, but if you, Paul, like basically said, you know, does your company have a formal policy on basically recovery time, recovery point objectives when there's some kind of an outage or something that takes place?
No, we don't have an objective beyond it needs to be faster than it was the last time. That was about 24 hours it took to recover manual server rebuild. So the expectation, fortunately for me, is that the bar has been set kind of low. Anything that I can do that's going to be better than that is going to be a success. I do understand, and to speak to that, the cost piece of it does have a lot to do with the amount of time to recovery. The Amazon cloud, from what I've been able to see, actually they offer the slowest service of all of them. And that being the case, maybe that's not the solution for somebody that wants to use it for primary backup storage. But for me, I think it's going to work well because I'm not looking for that kind of performance. I'm looking for the archiving piece of it, and the lower cost solutions seems to make sense.
Some of the hosting providers and sort of regional resellers who are building out private hosting environments or managed services environments are starting to offer services where they not only do a sort of a cloud-based backup at their site, but also become the recovery site. Have you looked at any of those, and have you thought about recovering your applications in the cloud? Is that possible or not possible for you?
It may be possible. It was a technology that I'm not, I actually wasn't even familiar that it was available yet. People using the cloud for their primary storage, eliminating SANs in their data center. It sounds fabulous. It almost sounds too good to be true. If I understood the question, John, is that right? Is that what you were asking?
That's right.
About primary storage?
Essentially, enabling Right now, UV motion, you can recover your applications, but do you UV motion between the two data centers today?
No, we don't.
Right.
No, we don't. The only thing that that secondary data center does is log-on authentication for their local server, the local virtual machine there that does authentication and printing, print services. The other, the only other purpose for the equipment there is for DR.
What about RPO? We talked about RTO. What about the recovery point objective? Is that something that you've looked at or have sensitivity to? I mean, how much data are you willing to lose?
We do a fair amount of CYA from a paper perspective. So I don't think that it's going to be as critical to have, you know, up to the minute data. If we went back to yesterday and had to manually key in, you know, potentially the data that we lost, it would be for the world.
It'd be transactions from your reps in the field or right, things like that.
Right.
Are your customers entering orders online or not?
We do have an internal e-ordering system. So there may be a potential where they would have to rekey their orders. The nice thing with the system, though, is they get a printout when they place their orders, so that can be rekeyed as well.
Okay.
Can I ask about your current storage vendor? Do they offer any services through local VARs or service providers that would allow you a two-phase type solution in some backup to their site and then from there to the cloud?
Well, HP does offer cloud service. They're one of my primary storage providers. My other primary storage provider is a company called CoRaid, and they've recently released a product called EtherCloud. I don't know anything about it yet other than the name. Exagrid, the backup appliance that I have right now, I'm supposed to be talking with their product roadmap lead, Mark Crespi, in the next couple of days, later on this week, actually. He and I are going to be speaking about what their plans are to offer some sort of cloud services. I'm really anxious to hear what he has to say, given that, I mean, in my mind, the most volatile market to be in is backup primary storage, given the enablement or the existence of the cloud. I mean, I think primary backup storage appliance vendors need to have some sort of a cloud offering if they're going to remain competitive in the market.
Did you ever look at a company called Yotabyte? Yotabyte? Yotabyte?
No. What do they offer?
They offer I don't know if they're online or not, but they offer a service in the cloud, basically, a method of providing a cloud support for that. That's they're a fairly new company, so I don't know how you feel about that, but they just come out of stealth, basically.
The one thing that seemed to be a recurring theme with the different providers is to try to keep it as close to being local as possible. Given that I'm up in northern Vermont, local for me is maybe the Boston area. excuse me. I found a company called ZetaGrid that actually sounded like they had exactly what I needed. When I looked into it a little bit further, I found out that they were based out of Australia, so there went that idea. given their location, the latency would have just been awful. Given that I'm looking for archiving, maybe that is a viable solution. I don't know. I mean, I can't dismiss it completely, but proximity to the cloud storage provider is a consideration though that needs to be made.
Yeah, I mean, that was my reason for asking about your current storage providers and Exagrid, because they would seem to be the obvious candidates for providing that service, and a number of them do it through local VARs, providing the interim translation from their product to the cloud.
That would be my hesitation though with the Yota service that you mentioned, the Yota
right.
The backup, Yota Grid backup. That would be my hesitation there with them being a startup. I'd have to know where they were located and go from there.
Paul, how much, if at all, does the cost of the backup software impact your backup strategy? You said you're a Veeam customer today. Right.
I would like to continue to use Veeam for my backup software. There's a lot of things that they do very, very well, so I want to make sure that I continue to partner with them and to take advantage of their products.
And how do they license? They license on a per server, per VM basis? What is it?
Per socket in the host.
Per socket.
So frequently we talk about a backup window. Is there a sort of DR window that you've got to hit, and or does that pose any limitations to you in terms of the time?
I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a DR window, with the exception being that since today my DR facility is a production location, and we've got folks that are trying to use computers out there. I mean, I can't use all available bandwidth to stream DR data out to the location. That would be a limiting factor there.
Okay.
So how much bandwidth do you have available?
I've got 5 megabits between locations, and I just increased our WAN link to the internet to 20 megabits.
Okay, and the amount of daily transfer between the two sites, the new data that you transfer between the two sites is approximately?
I couldn't tell you right now. I mean, we've got 6 servers that we're sending the DR data across. But again, that's trimmed right down to the bare minimum. If I had to design this from the beginning, and bandwidth and space was not a concern, there wouldn't be 6 servers that were sent over. There would be more than that.
Right.
What's the risk that you are exposed to by not backing up all the servers? What's the biggest issue for you
there? The person that takes my place is going to have to rebuild service level servers. They're going to have to find and re-download software installations, license keys, things that I've collected over the years to try to make my job a little easier. In addition, the email server lives over here right now. I can't remember if that's one of the ones that I'm sending over or not. It may be, actually. But they would be service level servers, antivirus servers, update servers.
So we're talking days to a week or more to sort of recover everything back to.
I don't know if all of it would be recoverable. I mean, some of the stuff are maybe little scripts that at some time I've written to make a job easier that I've saved. A lot of the stuff though would be retrievable. It would just take quite a lot of time and a lot of effort.
Sure. I want to just make sure anyone else have any questions on the phone.
So, just being very basic here, I mean, the methods that's been used for umpteen years is just take a tape and throw it over the transom to one of the Iron Mountains or other providers of that. Is that within your budget? Is that something that you could do if you couldn't find another solution? Or what's the alternative?
You're laughing at tape. Why are you laughing, Paul?
Because it's the technology that I happily did away with a number of years ago. It's been the Achilles heel of the IT industry for years, as far as I'm concerned. I've hated tape. It's no secret. Anybody that's ever met me and spoken with me or worked with me I've hated tape from the beginning. It's unreliable, CRC errors. I used to have to make 9-hour drives out to remote offices to work for an hour to change a defective DAT drive. Thank you, HP. it's just not a direction that I'm willing to go again. It really would feel like I'm in the field of technology and advancement and moving forward, and to do anything, even archiving with tape, would just feel like such a huge step backward, and it's not something that I'm willing to do.
There's a lot of, I'm not selling this, but there is a lot of improvement with LTO6 and the ability to index the tapes and the quality of those products these days. They've improved quite dramatically in the last few years. I'm just wondering, you know, if you couldn't find a cloud solution, would you be forced into something like that on a temporary basis? While you waited for the market to mature?
I think we heard over my dead body.
It would be over my newly purchased NAS device, because there's just no way that I'd go down the tape road again.
How about, I wonder if we could go back to Glacier for a minute, and a lot of questions folks had that remained unanswered, and I wonder if you in your research are able to find out. So, the big question is, how is Amazon able to get down to such a price point, and is it some kind of subsidy, or are they actually spinning down the disks to reduce power? That's what a number of people surmised, using some kind of ODM product or some kind of specialty disk product. Do you know, Paul, have you heard or learned in your discussions and your research how Amazon, you know, gets down to that price point?
I wouldn't say that it's so much of spinning down disks, although maybe after a period of time that's exactly what they do. My understanding is that initially when you back up to their service, like many of the other services, they make many copies of your data, spreading it throughout their data centers. In the event of a failure somewhere else, your data is still going to be accessible. And that's one of the things that they, along with the others, sell, is that you don't have to have a retention policy, or you don't have to have snapshots, because we create all that, we take care of all that stuff for you. The folks that are using cloud services for primary storage, those folks are saying, well, you don't even have to have a backup system in place, because we do all these snapshots and all this stuff for you. As far as how they get the cost down, maybe they do all this stuff up front when they get your stuff, and then they start spinning down disks. I'm not really sure. I don't have an answer for that. There's just a lot of, I could speculate for hours on how they do it.
But the penny a gigabyte per month is only the storage cost. It's not the transfer cost. It's not the put cost. It's not the get cost. And it's not the network.
There wouldn't be any get cost, because that penny solution only provides you the archiving, the long-term archiving piece of it.
Right. So as you're going through your analysis, I mean, have you created some sort of comparison document to a spreadsheet to look at what the real cost is on each of these?
Do you think that I should do something like that?
Yeah, I think you know what? Tell you what. Let's build that together, and let's put it on the Wikibon site. Okay. And then we can have all the suppliers fill in their numbers.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
I think it's a great idea. So, Dave, let's get that going. What do you think?
This is David Sawyer again. Obviously, part of your selection criteria is confidence in the supplier, and presumably you want the ability to be able to move between suppliers. So seeding the data and moving the data between sites is one of the big issues here, isn't it, that you've uncovered. Do you have any thoughts on that, on how you would protect yourself from somebody going bankrupt or from just needing to move it because Amazon just suddenly move it up to 10 cents per gigabyte per month?
Well, those are definitely things that need to be considered. You know, and in the case of the new startup, that would definitely be a concern of mine, going with a brand new provider of the service, as opposed to somebody who's a larger, you know, more widely known name like Amazon. That would definitely be a concern for me, and it will weigh heavily on ultimately what decision I make.
We touched on the retrieval costs, and you stated up front that your hope would be you never have to go get the data. But in the case of a catastrophe, you know, I've read some math at a 3 terabyte, you know, retrieval, because Amazon lets you retrieve, I think, 5% of your data a day. So somebody did the math, and it came out to about $22,000 to retrieve 3 terabytes of data. That was what they posted. So. In the event of a catastrophic, you know, disaster, is that something that, you know, management understands and would be prepared to eat, because it is a disaster? So okay, you got to write a check for $22,000 to get it all the data back. But is that something that you've actually posed to management as a, you know, worst case scenario? And do you think they would swallow that?
I haven't posed that question directly. I do think that they would swallow it, because when I looked at what it would cost me to augment the existing Exagrid physical appliance that I have today, mm-hmm. that's $13,000.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I said too. So, I mean, whether I spend $13,000 today or $20,000, maybe 10 years from now, maybe if the meteor maybe falls.
Yeah, so it's a probability that you're going to have to spend that $22,000 over the next 10 years. You might have to spend it once over 10 years versus the CapEx of $13,000 today.
$13,000 that you're going to have to add to later on, because all of a sudden we just ran out of storage again.
Yeah, and that's almost a certainty.
Yeah, each upgrade is going to be a couple of years now, right, maybe.
Exactly.
The last question that I have is that you've got your current backup solution, which you're happy with. There are other backup solutions which do have an interface to the cloud, and I'm thinking of companies like Asegra. I don't know whether you've ever looked at those, but they have a business model which allows local providers to provide that sort of service under their own banner. Is that something you've looked at? I mean, that they are fairly squarely positioned for the mid-market and SMB.
I'm open for ideas. I mean, I've only been able to investigate a small handful of them. If there are some out there that are better or offering anything different, I'm all ears and certainly open to recommendations if anybody sees any based on what my environment is and what our needs are.
Yeah, one of the hopes out of today.
No, I have not.
One of the hopes out of today's call was that we'd be able to provide Paul with some input on directions that he should investigate, directions he could go. So it does sound to me like there's the archive cost, but there's a bunch of stuff in the middle to get you to the archive, and then there's a significant cost to get it out of the archive. So to the extent that you can impact either of those factors, then I think it's an important part of the decision-making process.
I would definitely talk to Asegra. Now, my understanding is, David Floyer, that Asegra would power cloud service providers. They wouldn't sell it directly unless you're building your own private cloud, but they work with a number of cloud service providers.
That's
Asegra
right.
Asegra is a small business specialist. And they've been around forever. I think they're a Canadian-based company, but they sell to a lot of cloud service providers and have a very good reputation for cost-effective cloud backup.
We got to meet with them last week at Storage Field Day. They were pretty impressive. I'd never heard of them because they're, you know, provider-focused, but they were pretty impressive.
The other one, and I think it's going to take a little more investigation, and in the interest of disclosure, I used to work, used to do some work with the company, but it's a company called IDERA, I-D-E-R-A, based out of Houston, and they provide a backup software product to back up basically applications in the cloud, and so if you host your servers in a hosting environment or a infrastructure as a service environment, they're likely to be the backup supplier for that. They've got like 275,000 servers that they're backing up today, but I know they're going after the more enterprise environments now, and so backing up from that to a cloud service provider might be an option. So that's I will ask one of them to comment on that. And so we'll try to get you some input there. They just launched the new enterprise version today and the enterprise pricing today. So. Well, it sounds to me like we've got a lot of to-dos here. So, Paul, you and I need to work together on this matrix for how to evaluate all of the factors in going to a cloud backup, and then try to encourage all the vendors to supply cost information. We've got you helped tease out a number of the factors that maybe some of the other analysts had thought about, but I hadn't heard as much about. So what I would encourage anyone who's on the call or anyone who knows companies who've gone through this transition, encourage people to contribute, provide input, feedback on what we've learned today and what we hope to learn over the course of the next couple of weeks. I want to thank Scott Lowe, David Flory, Dave Vellante for joining me here today on the call, as well as everyone else who's watching live on SiliconANGLE TV and or who dialed in on the call today. Just as a reminder, we'll have 6 research notes up on wikibon.org over the course of the next couple of days. So feel free to read, contribute, edit, enhance the documents as we put them up there. If you're not registered on wikibon.org, it's a very simple registration process. So please, and Paul, that includes you, please jump in and edit, contribute, and help the Wikibon community. So again, Paul Martin, IT manager at Poole & Grain, we appreciate you being with us here today and expressing your challenges and the approaches that you're looking at. Also, just want to remind you that in 2 weeks' time, we have our next Peer Insight. We'll be we'll have Dag Leoden, who's Chief Technology Officer at Tappad, and the topic is Optimizing Infrastructure for Analytics-Driven Real-Time Decision-Making. So we're going to move from the SMB to the to big data here in the next 2 weeks. So looking forward to that. Just also as a reminder, we'll have a podcast of this research meeting up on SiliconANGLE TV, maybe on a YouTube channel, on the Wikibon channel on YouTube, and a rebroadcast of the audio in the Peer Insight archive. So thanks for joining us here today, John MacArthur, Peer Insight moderator at Wikibon. Thanks for joining us. Take care.